Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Assistant Editor Skylar Jeremias. Despite the United States having had a biosimilar pathway for a decade now, the industry has launched just 17 biosimilars on the market, well behind the pace in Europe and India. Several pieces of legislation have been introduced in Congress to help boost uptake, generate savings for payers and patients, and increase biosimilar access. However, not every bill is likely to become a law, as politics and money can often get in the way. We sat down with Ha-Koon Wong, an intellectual property law attorney and partner at Venable Fitzpatrick in New York, and April Breyer Menon, an expert on biosimilar patent law and founder of April Breyer Consulting in Chicago, Illinois, to discuss potential bills to improve biosimilar uptake and their chances for passage. The Biologic Patent Transparency Act would force innovator companies to make public the patents protecting their products and is intended to limit the filing of patents to block ongoing biologic product applications. Ha-Koon, why has patent transparency become a problem?
It's kind of like asking, why didn't the Chicago Bulls re-sign Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan in 1999 and give them one more chance to win a seventh championship ring? The answer, which is there were lots of problems. Same is true here. But I think that there's one reason that's particularly relevant. As we know, biologic drugs are very scientifically complex, as most come from living organisms, aren't as simple as small molecules, where everything is essentially just a handful of carbons, oxygens, and hydrogens. There are often many more patents filed on each biologic drug because of this complexity, including composition of matter, formulation, methods of use, and most importantly, manufacturing patents, something that might not have been as important for the small molecule space. So some innovator biologic drug manufacturers, because of this, have identified over 100 patents that potentially cover aspects of the drug. And with all the scientific and manufacturing complexity, it can be difficult for an innovator to determine exactly which patents cover which aspects of the product, which means it could be even more difficult for a biosimilar manufacturer to identify all of the potential patents that may cover its biosimilar product. So as a result of this, biosimilar manufacturers may not have a complete understanding of what patent issues they may face in the future prior to committing resources to development. And this is a very, very different scenario than from the generic small molecule drug manufacturer that has much more patent transparency because they can view the list of patents covering small molecule drugs in the Orange Book. So as you can see, doing something similar for biologics may reduce issues with patent transparency in the field. So the Biologic Patent Transparency Act would require innovator companies to list patents for which a holder or exclusive licensee, quote, believes a claim of patent infringement could reasonably be asserted by the holder in the FDA's Purple Book. So it would end up being kind of the biologic version of the Orange Book, if you will. However, while the senator's comments on the bill states that it will target, quote unquote, patent thickets by limiting enforcement of patents issued after a biosimilar application has been submitted to the FDA, the actual text of the bill does not include this provision. Thus, the bill currently will not limit the filing of patents that could impact potential biosimilars.
How will the act increase transparency and create advantages for biosimilar manufacturers?
Well, I think there's a couple things to consider. First of all, it adds information to the Purple Book, such as biosimilarity and interchangeability designations, exclusivities, approved indications. It makes the Purple Book searchable. In other words, it actually makes the Purple Book usable and useful, like the Orange Book is. So I think there's some benefit there. It also specifically requires that in the Purple Book, you list compositions, method of use, and method of manufacturing patents. That's something different than what you see in the Orange Book, which the holder, or in some cases, the exclusive licensee, quote, believes a claim of patent infringement could reasonably be asserted by the holder, which is similar to the requirement for listing in the Orange Book, that they also say that you want to list any patent where patent infringement could reasonably be asserted. So there is some parallel there, and we've seen how useful the Orange Book is, so this could make the Purple Book more useful. Now, of course, there's this penalty for failing to timely list a patent. You can't bring an infringement action under the BPCIA if you don't list a patent, and that's pretty draconian, and that's something we'll talk about in a little bit. But because biosimilar manufacturers would know in advance if they have this listing which patents they could be infringing, they may be able to challenge patents earlier in the product development process or attempt to design around the patents. This may impact the pace of patent dispute processes and get biosimilars to market more quickly. Another potential advantage to biosimilar applicants is that they could essentially circumvent the BPCIA patent dance by choosing not to provide the RPS, or the reference product sponsor, a copy of their ABLA to start this patent dance process, but they would still have the benefit of knowing which patents could be asserted against them pursuant to this listing in the Purple Book.
Contrary to the way it appears on the surface, this bill is highly complex and perhaps impracticable. Can you explain why?
Well, on the one hand, it's very challenging for a reference product sponsor to know which patents to list. So with a strict penalty for failing to list, the number of patents in play may actually increase, since an RPS may be more likely to list any patent that could possibly be reasonably relevant, which still leads to each litigation being determined on a case-by-case basis after evaluating all the applicable patents during the patent dance. Ultimately, this may then have little impact on the speed of litigation. Now, on the other hand, there may be minimal incentive for an RPS to list patents like there is in the Hatch-Waxman, because there's no specific accrued benefit, like the promise of a 30-month stay of generic small molecule drug approval. So that's, maybe they would not want to list at all. So this does, of course, as I mentioned earlier, have this penalty of barring infringement claims, and that doesn't exist in the Hatch-Waxman space. And some people may see this as being too harsh of a penalty. So that's another thing that could be an issue. And then, of course, it could be seen as potentially inconsistent with the entire process of the BPCIA. I mean, Congress did go through and put together a pretty elaborate scheme for trading patent information in the BPCIA that would be absolutely shortcutted from this process that was not contemplated at all by the BPCIA or Congress when they passed it. And then, of course, altogether, this could lead to further disincentivizing the use of the patent dance by a biosimilar, because why would they need it anymore? They have the list of patents in the Purple Book. And then at the end of the day, this doesn't even actually limit the number of patents that a RPS could obtain on a biologic. So it's really unclear how this would address the so-called patent thickets.
Given all that, is there a way to make this bill workable and gain more transparency?
Well, that's akin to asking whether there's anything we could do to make the last Star Wars movie more watchable, the answer of which is probably not. But that's an interesting question here, because there are interesting aspects in the bill's current form worth saving, such as improving information in the Purple Book, like biosimilarity, interchangeability designations, exclusivities, and improved indications, all of which make the Purple Book more beneficial to everybody. Now, perhaps one potential change could be to provide an explicit incentive for listing the patents in the Purple Book and making the penalty for failing to list the patent less severe, similar to what we see in Hatch-Waxman, where there's a 30-month stay of approval given for patents listed in the Orange Book, and the penalty there for failing to list patents is simply just you don't have the 30-month stay approval and not the complete removal of your ability to enforce the patent. So perhaps that way it becomes more of a give and take, like the Orange Book space, and it might be more palatable to all sides and plus more practical in terms of effects.
The Affordable Paid Prescription Drug Importation Act would allow the United States to import select lower-priced drugs from Canada, possibly leading to drug imports from other countries. American people are strongly in favor of this type of legislation, but there are some very real problems with this bill. Can you explain this, Hakung?
So I'll do this in summary fashion, because there are a lot of problems here. First of all and foremost, there may be quality and safety concerns about allowing people to take drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA. We all know the story of thalidomide from the 1950s and how it was approved overseas and it led to tragic birth defects, and that was never approved by the FDA. Clearly, we have the FDA for a reason. Bypassing its requirements can be very dangerous. And secondly, drug availability may be an issue. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if only 20% of US prescriptions were to be sourced from Canada, we would exhaust the entire Canadian drug supply in 183 days, which I don't think Canadians would be happy about. And of course, that's reflected in what Canadian officials have said. They've generally been opposed to this policy for that very reason. And ultimately, it may not be even an efficient way to lower drug prices as compared to just simply implementing pricing restrictions similar to those that were implemented in Canada. And finally, we have actually had similar policies introduced in 2003 and 2017. Neither passed. It's unclear why this would be any different.
Given all that, How would you rate this bill's chances of passage?
Well, I'd say this bill's chances of passage are about as high as the chance that Carol Baskins from the Netflix documentary, The Tiger King, wasn't involved with her ex-husband's disappearance. She was super shady, but I digress. While this bill appears to have significant public support, the logistics may not be feasible. Canada doesn't have the drug supply necessary to supply the U.S., and if only a fraction of the drugs are imported from Canada, the savings are going to be minimal. And of course, with the potential safety concerns about passing the FDA, I'd say it'd be challenging for this bill to pass.
The BioSim Act will temporarily increase reimbursement for biosimilar drugs to average sale price, or ASP, plus 8% up from the current 6% plus ASP. So, April, what's the idea behind paying physicians more for using biosimilars?
The idea is that financial encouragement may help to increase the uptake of biosimilars, which we know has been an issue so far in the U.S. So currently, biosimilars and reference products are reimbursed at the same rate. So that means that each one is reimbursed at their average sales price, and then 6% of the reference product's average sales price is added to that. So from a reimbursement perspective, there's really no incentive to prescribe one drug over the other. Now, there might actually be increased costs to the doctor in prescribing a biosimilar. Some examples would be that they may have to spend extra time with the patients explaining what biosimilars are and answering their questions. If they're switching from a reference product to a biosimilar, they would have to explain the risks and benefits of that. They might have to spend extra time monitoring and following up with the patient. And so all of that together could make prescribing the biosimilar a less attractive alternative. So the idea is that this added reimbursement for biosimilars might help doctors offset those potential increased costs.
How would you rate this bill's chances of passage as currently packaged?
Well, so right now, this bill is packaged as an amendment to the Lower Drug Costs Now Act, which is a very extensive drug pricing bill that came out of the House. And because of the way it's packaged, it might have a difficult time passing just because of some of those other provisions in that act. One example is that another provision allows the government to negotiate drug prices paid by Medicare. And that provision in particular has been opposed by a number of people in Congress, particularly Republicans, because they feel it interferes with the free market. So even if this drug itself might not have so many issues because of its packaging, it may make it rather difficult to pass.
So Hakum, in an election year, how might this dynamic spur or hinder the passage of drug price legislation?
Well, we all know that the Trump administration can be unpredictable, not only on Twitter, but in terms of policy. It seems like drug pricing is something that was a priority. So President Trump may push for legislation, but it's unclear at this point since there's so many other priorities in the immediate horizon, not the least of which is COVID-19 and the economy. Regardless, the public is generally in favor of drug pricing initiatives. So we may see legislators try to push something through or at least provide some demonstrable progress as part of their bid for re-election or in support of their party. However, let's not forget the lobbyists, as many companies and groups that contribute to campaigns appear to oppose many of these bills, which may lead to limited congressional support.
Not to forget about the COVID-19 pandemic, how does this play into the success or failure of the legislation we've discussed?
Well, with all the attention currently focused on COVID-19, Congress has had limited ability to be in session and debate these bills. So clearly, that makes it difficult for these bills to progress. But COVID-19 could have a long-term impact on U.S. healthcare. So it will be interesting to see where some of this legislation could go, as health concerns are at the forefront of everyone's mind, including politicians. Clearly, access to medications is in part based on IP and regulatory requirements, and COVID-19 is a clear example of a virus unchecked by any developed treatment. The current increased focus on finding better medications for future potential pandemics may spur increased interest in passing bills that impact future biologic drug uptake, particularly with respect to vaccines.
Even if legislation can speed approval of biosimilars, we still have issues with uptake. Can you explain?
Well, while the uptake has been increasing, the biosimilar market share still significantly lags behind reference products for most drugs. Even if more drugs are approved, the U.S. still needs to make efforts to increase awareness and education on biosimilars for doctors and patients. Biologic and biosimilar drug prices may also require more significant control by the government to encourage use of those drugs by doctors who are less familiar with them and also subject to taking up more of their time to administer them, since they may need to spend more time educating patients on biosimilars, answering questions, and in turn have increased follow-up appointments. So ultimately, you need to get buy-in from the politicians, the payers, the physicians, and the patients, and all that is a very tall order.
Thank you, Hokung and April, for your insights, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information in the show notes, and until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.